You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Faith is not wishful thinking. It's not wishing upon a star. It's not just that I hope that this is true. Instead, when we come to the Bible, we see that biblical faith is not blind faith. Peter writes in 1 Peter 3:15, a really classic verse, he says, in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord, always being prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. Yet, do this with gentleness and respect. So according to Peter, the way in which we're supposed to communicate our faith is not just that we have a feeling, though we do, but also that we have facts. We're supposed to give answers to people that ask, why is it that you have hope in the God of the Bible? Well, we're going to launch from that passage into sort of a topical study of why we should believe in God. And to begin, we should ask this question, who cares if God even exists? Well, I agree with Richard Dawkins, one of the four horsemen of the new atheism. That's his own description, not mine. He said in Time magazine in 2006, the question of whether there exists a supernatural creator, a God, is one of the most important that we have to answer. Whether or not we are just a sack of chemicals and juices and electricity, a biochemical machine, whether or not there's an afterlife, you don't care about that? Are you kidding me? Like if I could say, here's a pill that would extend your life, you know, from 80 to 160. Or if I could say to you, you know, here's a medicine that could help your quality of life until you live to the age of 200. Wouldn't you be at least interested in that? Sure you would. Of course you would. Now, even in a fallen world, we'd be interested in that. How much more with the idea of living in an unfallen, perfect, glorious new creation in heaven? Not for 80 years, not postponing the inevitable, but for eternity. Yes, I would want to know if there is a God. That is sure. The next question we should ask is why we should believe that God exists. And really, to put this very simply, very tersely, the reason that I would say I believe in God is that he is the best explanation for reality. The best explanation for reality. And really, we're going to look at certain core features of reality, not peripheral issues in the Bible or in reality. We're going to look at the core aspects of reality, things that you just bumped into every day. For example, the universe. That's something that we would bump into quite a bit. What is the best explanation for the existence and origin of the universe itself? Paul says in Acts 17, in him we live and move and have our being. The Bible declares from the very first verse that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And so, is that claim true? Well, back in 1948, philosopher Bertrand Russell, in a debate with philosopher who is a Christian philosopher, Frederick Copleston, on BBC radio, no less, was asked by Copleston, what do you think about the universe? Why is the universe here? To which Russell replied, I should say that the universe is just there and that's all. It's just there. What do you mean, why is the universe there? It's just there and that's all. Well, he could get away with that in 1948. He cannot get away with that today. Today, scientists tell us that the universe is not eternal, but actually had an origin 13.7 billion years in the past. And there is a confluence of different arguments for why we would believe this. The second law of thermodynamics, that energy is becoming more and more useless and winding down, which means that there needed to be an infusion of energy. Of course, Big Bang cosmology came on the scene with the work of Albert Einstein in 1917, where he discovered that the universe was either expanding or contracting, but it couldn't be static. It couldn't just be just there. It needed to be either expanding or contracting. In 1929, Edwin Hubble studied that the stars had a red shift. If they had a blue shift, the spectrum of light would be contracted, and this would mean that the stars were moving closer and closer together. But, to Hubble's surprise, all of the stars had a red shift. This means that the spectrum of light was being stretched, and the universe was expanding. So on and so forth, into the 60s, the 80s, we find that the universe, over and over again, is shown to have a beginning at what is called the Big Bang cosmology. Now, the late Stephen Hawking, who was an agnostic physicist, and his colleague Roger Penrose, writes this: almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Alexander Vilenkin, out of Tufts University, he writes this: it is said that an argument is what convinces a reasonable man, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. And again, in 2012, all the evidence that we have says that the universe had a beginning. And again, in 2012, regarding other cosmological theories, none of these scenarios can actually be past eternal. That is to say, they had a beginning. And again, in 2015, we have no viable models of an eternal universe. The Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem gives reason to believe that such models simply cannot be constructed. Now think about that for a moment. The universe had a beginning at the Big Bang, but this asks the question, if you have a Big Bang, what do you need? A Big Banger. You need something to bring the universe into existence, and you can't have nothing bring something into existence. That claim, the idea that nothing could bring something into existence, that is stretching my credulity to the breaking point. I don't have enough faith to believe that. That is more extraordinary than any miracle in the Bible I have ever read before. Water into wine, parting of the Red Sea, because at least in those cases in the Bible, you have a God, a personal causative agent who can perform a miracle. This is saying that no one performed the miracle. Nothing created something, but it's saying something even further than that. It isn't just saying that nothing created something. No. It's instead saying that nothing created everything. Absolutely everything. That stretches my credulity. I can't believe that. If somebody held a gun to my head and said, do you believe that nothing created everything? No. Because in order for the universe to exist, something needed to bring it into being. The universe couldn't create itself. You know, it makes sense to say that X created Y, but it makes no sense to say that X created X. For to create X, X had to already exist. And some people say that's really deep. It's not deep. It's a contradiction. There's nothing deep about it. What is the best explanation? That there's something outside of the universe, spaceless, timeless, immaterial, and incommensurably powerful. Number two, what is the best explanation for the organization of the universe? Since about 1974, Brandon Carter discovered that the laws, constants, and initial conditions of the universe are exquisitely, finely tuned, and here's the key word, I'm choosing my words carefully, finely tuned for the possibility of life. Not that it would be probable, not that evolution could have gone a different way, no. The fine tuning of the universe states that these laws, constants, and initial conditions needed to be exquisitely, finely tuned for life to be possible. Who believes this? Everybody. Everybody from Oxford to Stanford and everywhere in between. And by the way, tonight, one thing I'm not going to do is quote to you from any Christians. I'm not going to quote from any believers in God. The only people whom I will quote will be atheists or agnostics. Okay, fair enough. So I'm kind of climbing into the ring here with both hands tied behind my back, but I just want to play fair and show what secular thinkers think about these subjects. Well, what are we talking about here when we say that they're exquisitely finely tuned? Let's compare the ratio of subatomic particles, electrons to protons. This ratio needs to be finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 36th power. If it was off by one part in 10 to the 36th, we wouldn't have galaxies, stars, or planets, just gas. Now, I know in science fiction movies like, you know, the old Star Trek shows, they would have, you know, gas beings and stuff that had consciousness. Okay, that's for the 1960s in Star Trek. That's not for reality. We don't have consciousness from this. Well, we'd have life. It would have evolved a different way. No galaxies, no stars, no planets, no heavy rocks, nothing like this. What about the N constant? Electromagnetism to gravity. This is one part in 10 to the 37th power. Do you know what that means? A 1 with 37 zeros after it. Okay? And if we saw this increased just by one part in 10 to the 37th, no small stars, which we need to have a slow burn, to have an equitable planet. And if it was decreased, we would have no large stars, which seed the galaxy and the universe with some of the other elements, hydrogen and helium, respectively. So we wouldn't have life. What about gravity, the strong force versus the weak force? This is finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 50th power, a 1 with 50 zeros after it. If larger, no galaxies. If smaller, the universe would have collapsed by now. Let's look at just the gravitational constant. This is basically Newton's equation, which was used by Einstein, which is used today. It's the force of gravity. What is the force of gravity? It's equal to G, the gravitational constant, multiplied by the mass of one object, multiplied by the mass of a second object, M1 and M2, divided by the radius squared in between. So M1 could be the sun, M2 could be the earth. M1 could be the moon, M1 could be a star in the Andromeda galaxy. M1 and M2 could change. And the radius squared in between the two objects, that could change. But the gravitational constant is always, always, always the same. This constant needs to be finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 40th power. So just to put that in perspective here, one part in 10 to the 40th power is a 1 with 40 zeros after it. Let's say tonight you're feeling very lucky and you're thinking, I want to go play the lottery, and you get your ticket for the Powerball. What would be the chances that you would win the Powerball, that you would be able to hit the big box and you could retire and your kids would retire and your grandkids would retire? That's one part in 300 billion. One part in 300 billion. Excuse me, 300 million. Yeah. Subtract three zeros. One part in 300 million to win the Powerball. Now, how lucky would you feel if you won the Powerball? Pretty lucky. This is something totally different what we're talking about here. One part in 10 to the 40th power. Now, I know you might be saying, well, you're just adding a couple zeros. Every zero is multiplying that number by 10. We're talking about exponents here. So one part in 10 to the 40th is 10 times one part in 10 to the 39th. We're not just adding a little bit. We're adding exponentially here. What about the number of cells in the human body? 37 trillion. What about the number of seconds in the universe? 13.6 billion years. That's 1 in 10 to the 18th power. Let's think about it like this, just to kind of grasp what we're speaking of here. Imagine we could look at the entire material universe from a God's eye view from one end to the other. And let's say that we had an incredibly large Stanley tape measure, and we could measure the universe from one end to the other, billions of light years apart. And we could break this up into inches. If the gravitational constant was just one inch weaker, no life. If it was one inch stronger, no life. It needs to be perfectly within that one inch across the entire material universe, what has been called by Paul Davies the Goldilocks effect. Not too weak, not too strong, not too soft, not too hard, just right. The problem with this illustration is that this is only 10 to the 28th inches here. This doesn't even come close to what we're describing with just one of these constants here. What are some of the other constants? It gets worse. The lambda constant, the cosmological constant. This is finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 120th power. That's a one with 120 zeros after it. If larger, the universe would just be a helium and hydrogen soup. So, not propitious for life, to say the least. What about the low entropy of the universe? You're going to think that I'm making an error here. This comes from Roger Penrose of Oxford University. He says that the low entropy of the universe is one part in 10 to the 10 raised to the 123rd power. Penrose comically says in one of his lectures, that number is so large that if we were to write a zero on every subatomic particle in the universe, there wouldn't be enough particles to write that number. He says, I can cheat by writing two exponents rather than just one. So how do we explain this here? 30 laws, constants, and initial conditions. How do you explain that? Just to get one of them, like that low entropy of the universe, you'd be thinking you're in a good situation. No. Then we got the cosmological constant, the gravitational force. And these all have to have a confluence where we have life being permissible, prohibited in the universe. Well, what would we believe here? That this just happened by chance? See, that would just, I can't believe that. I just cannot believe that. If a guy was playing poker and, you know, he was the dealer and he dealt himself a royal flush, I'd be going, wait a minute, I don't buy that. A royal flush, that's, the chances of that is 1 in 650,000. What if he did it a second time? What if he did it a third time? What if he did it a fourth time? What if he did it 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power? At some point, you'd be going, you know, I'm out of this game, right? I'm not giving you my money. There's something sneaky afoot here. It's almost like someone was designing whether or not those cards would be dealt in that way. Well, from a macro level, we're seeing the same thing here. This is not chance. This is not chance. Fine-tuning happened most reasonably because there was a fine-tuner. And I've heard people say, well, probably it was aliens. Okay, aliens, if they exist, would be in the universe. This is talking about the fine-tuning of the universe. No, it cannot be ET. All right, number three. What is the best explanation for objective moral values and duties? You know, goodness, love would be moral values, and duties would be things like you shouldn't steal, you should be charitable, you should be kind, you should be tolerant. What's the best explanation for objective morality? Not subjective, not just like my personal opinion. But is there such a thing as objective morality, something that's actually real? Like when I say, torturing someone for fun is wrong. Am I saying something about myself, the subject, that I get grossed out by torturing people for fun? Or am I saying that there's something out there that's wrong with torturing someone for fun? That act out there, the object, that's wrong. Well, people who come from a naturalistic worldview, that is to say, they only believe in nature and nothing beyond it, just matter and energy and motion. That's it. They have a problem. This is referred to as Hume's guillotine. It's called the is-ought problem. How do you go from what is the case in nature to what ought be the case? So think of it like this. Every event in the universe is natural. Moral atrocities are events in the universe. Therefore, moral atrocities are natural and couldn't have been otherwise. Why is it that we would look across the world and we see lions eating gazelles? We see a race of ants enslaving a race of aphids. We see dolphins forcibly copulating with other dolphins. And we look at that and we say, that's just nature. That's just the way nature is. But then we look at a child being neglected and we say, that's wrong. We see racism, sexism. We say, that's wrong. How do you go from an is, what is the case, to what ought be the case? Furthermore, what makes humans valuable? Why are we different than the other species on planet Earth? Is it some kind of a physical difference? We have less body hair than our primate cousins, most of us. We walk upright. I guess that's different. True. Yeah. We have that opposable thumb. That's nice. I guess that's true. Yeah. But wait, so if we just had different physical, what if those physical differences were taken away? Would that make any difference whatsoever? No. You know, I'm just under 200 pounds. And if you got a bag full of cockroaches that was 200 pounds, we would be very similar as far as our chemical compounds. I might have a little bit more calcium than the bag of cockroaches, but what really is the difference between us? From a naturalistic perspective, physical differences, that can't be it. What about social behavior? Well, we have certain social taboos and customs, yet these could change on a whim. I mean, I guess we wear clothes. We're the only species that does that, except for those people that put their dogs in a pantsuit, you know. But you take away the pantsuit or you put it on, that doesn't confer value. That can't be it. What about intelligence? Well, humans are way more intelligent. And so this would demonstrate that humans, oh, that's why we're valuable. Yeah. Again, what if you took that away? What if you have an infant who is far less intelligent than many animals? You say, well, eventually they're going to become more intelligent. Yeah, eventually. We're talking about right now. That infant is less intelligent than animals. What about people with severe mental disabilities? What about people who are comatose? What about people who are asleep? Not very intelligent. What if we took one or more of these properties away? If we say this is the reason for human value, anything that we give it to, we could just as easily take it away. Here's Peter Singer. Now, I'm not quoting to you from atheistic websites. This is from an introductory graduate textbook on ethics from an ethicist at Princeton University. He writes this. He says, human babies are not born self-aware. That's true. Or capable of grasping that they exist over time. Probably also true. They are not persons. You see what he did there? He said they're human beings, but they're not human persons. So he's divorcing human being from human doing. That there's something about being a human. See, in a biblical worldview, every person has value because they're in the human family. We're human beings. We get value from being who we are. In his view, you need to have human doing. You need to have a certain functional ability. So Singer has said that even killing babies up to 2 or 3 years old is a morally gray case. It's a morally gray case, because at what point does someone become sentient? So he writes this, the life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. So next time you go to the hospital, you see that sweet little baby, say, you know, this is such a cute little child, but, you know, Babe the pig, way more valuable than your kid, way more valuable. You've never seen the movie Babe. Michael Ruse and E.O. Wilson, agnostic philosopher and Harvard biologist. Human beings function better if they are deceived by their genes into thinking that there is a disinterested, objective morality binding upon them, which all should obey. This is something that we inherited from evolution, and we think that there's morality, but it's just not even the case. Again, in 1989, they said ethics, as we understand it, is an illusion. Fobbed off on us by our genes in order to get us to cooperate. Natural selection selected for certain cooperative behaviors, troop behavior, working together, and so we just think that this is normal. John Gray, atheistic philosopher, he says, in the monotheistic faiths, God is the guarantor of human life. However, human life has no more meaning than the life of a slime mold. His book is called Straw Dogs. It's a practice in Chinese culture where you create these straw dogs and they're very popular and they look really nice. But then at the end of the ceremony, you light them on fire. And he says this is illustrative of human life, that for a moment, a little bit for a ceremony, we call them sacred. We call human life important, valuable, but eventually it's gone. Alex Rosenberg, this is The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Is there free will? Not a chance. What is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Why should I be moral? Because it makes you feel better than being immoral. Oh, yeah. There you go. There's an explanation. Why should I be moral? Because it makes me feel good. The question is, what if it doesn't make you feel good? Does history have any meaning or purpose? It is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Those famous words from Macbeth. After Lady Macbeth dies, no, there's no point. There's no purpose to life, obviously. If all we are is just a bunch of chemicals and electrochemical biological machines, what is the point? How do we have value? We have no value. Michael Shermer, atheistic historian of science, he says, why should we be moral is like asking, why should we be hungry or why should we be horny? See what he's saying here? That the evolutionary process, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, basically created certain impulses or throbs into us that we feel like we need to do that, like we have hunger, and so natural selection selected for that so that we would survive. We feel erotic pleasure, horniness, so we go out there and we try and spread our seed. Natural selection selected for this. Same thing is true with morality. This is something that was just an impulse or a drive or a throb that was programmed into us so that when we see people that are hurting in our species, we want to go help them. And that's why we have these feelings of morality. Think about that for a second. Franz de Waal, he says evolution selected for a benevolent impulse. Benevolent meaning good. A benevolent impulse. Okay, this does not explain morality. Not even close. I mean, not at all. Zero. I don't know how much more I could say here. This does not explain it. I read in the paper, you know, popular science, oh, evolution has explained morality. Okay, first of all, this is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about objective morality, not subjective. What is evolution? Evolution means change over time. And something which is objective is true regardless of a passage of time. So this is clearly admitting this is subjective morality. That I was programmed a certain way by my genes, and that's just the way that it is. Evolution is a descriptive process, not a prescriptive process. You know, when you go to the zoo, you see certain behaviors in the primate species there. You know, sometimes they throw feces at each other. And we would look at that and we'd laugh, right? But we would never say, well, because they do it, therefore we should do it. Why? Because it's describing, it's descriptive of their behaviors. That doesn't mean that we should mimic those behaviors or that we ought to do those same behaviors. In fact, the question is, why are we choosing some primate behaviors and not others? Like true behavior, that's good. Throwing feces at each other's heads, that's bad. This is arguing in a circle. A benevolent impulse. You see how he smuggled that right in there? This is what they call begging the question. A benevolent impulse. That's great. So we have these impulses, that's true. But why couldn't evolution select for a good impulse? Do you see the problem here? He's smuggling in the very thing he's trying to prove. That's arguing in a circle. That's like saying, why is the Bible true? Well, because 1 Timothy 3:16 says so. That is the same exact logic that we're seeing here. A benevolent impulse. The question is, what is benevolence? What is the good? Not how do we account for it. It doesn't account for moral judgment or moral praise. To say that someone was, you know, doing something evil on this view, they just had an impulse or a drive or a throb to do evil. Or, contrarily, if someone does something good, you know, you see a doctor and she served with Doctors Without Borders, or a guy, he helped, you know, with an after-school program. You'd say, oh, that's a good person right there. They did something morally praiseworthy. Under this view, they did nothing different than having blue eyes and blonde hair. This was something that was selected for, that was passed on to them, that they couldn't have changed otherwise. And here is the final blow. What happens if a sadistic impulse overpowers a sacrificial impulse. Let me put that very simply. Ted Bundy had a set of impulses. Mother Teresa had a set of impulses. Which ones were good? Which ones were evil? You see, this doesn't even explain it at all. It doesn't even get us close to explaining it. All it would do is describe human behavior. It would never tell us which behaviors are good and which ones we ought to do. And so, how do we know morality is real? Well, I would just argue that we know this through direct perception. Direct first-person perception. Back in 1955, there was a young African-American boy by the name of Emmett Till. He went into a little, five-and-dime store, and he was accused of catcalling at a white woman in the South in the 1950s. Later that night, a couple of grown white men pulled Emmett Till from his house, tortured him, beat him, killed him, and threw his body into a river. The all-white jury acquitted the two men of killing Emmett Till. They found his body 3 days later in the water. They pulled it out, and it was grotesque. If you have a weak stomach, don't look at this next slide. They put him in the casket, and everyone said to the mother, Mamie, the mother, we need to have a closed casket. And she said, no. We're going to have an open casket. And they said, why? And she said, let the people see what I've seen. For the 1950s, this picture went viral and is really responsible for sparking the civil rights movement in America. Why? Because according to Mamie Till, the mother of Emmett Till, if people could just see racism and evil, they could know it. It's one thing to speak about racism in the abstract. It's another thing to see the bloated and beaten and bloody body of a little 14-year-old kid. So, what's your response to that imagery? I could show you picture after picture after picture until you were nauseated all night. What's your first-person response to that picture of Emmett Till? What would you call that? What would you call that? A sack of juices and chemicals that just expired? Has less electricity than it used to? Or would you call that, evil! Evil! That's what you would call that. This is similar to sensory perception. There's some people, they're called solipsists. You know what that means? They don't believe that the real world exists. They're thinking of Matrix 4 coming out soon, and they just can't wait. Because they just think that we're all in the Matrix, and we can't trust our physical senses, our five senses, see, touch, taste, smell, hear. None of this is real. It's more reasonable to believe that I'm just a brain in a vat, or I'm a butterfly dreaming about being a human. Now, for you, you might say, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. But how would you disprove it? How would you disprove it? You say, well, the scientific method. No, you need sensory perception to be able to do the scientific method. Well, what about your memories? Well, that could be true on solipsism, just as much as on any other view. You know how you disprove it? You say there's no reason that we should accept it to the contrary, that it's a properly basic belief that there is an external world out there. Think about it like this. What number is up there on the screen? I'm sorry. What number is up there on the screen? Yeah, 15. All right. 4.5% of you didn't know. And I know because you all wiped a tear as I said that. You're colorblind. You don't know the difference between those colors. You can't perceive that number, can you? No. Well, because 4.5% of us can't perceive that number, does that mean that I should say I can't see the number? See my point? Oh, well, some people would look at Emmett Till and they would see that bloated body and they would say there's nothing wrong with that. I'll tell you what, far less than 4.5%, that's for sure. And I could roll out one case after another. All I would have to show that objective morality is true, is just to give you one case of something that is objectively wrong. the Crusades, the Inquisition, anything, one thing to show that you could perceive that this is immoral, that it's wrong. And there's no good arguments that I've ever heard that deny that morality is real. So I have this direct personal intuition that is properly basic, so obvious, everyone can see it. People who can't see it, they don't need a class on philosophy, they need a therapist. And the rest of us can see it quite clearly. Morality is real. And I've never heard a good argument as to why we should discount this. What are the arguments someone could tell you that would say torturing a kid for fun is, it's not wrong? What argument would you need to hear for you to say, I guess I was wrong this whole time? Here's Louise Anthony. She's an atheistic philosopher. She says, any argument for moral skepticism will be based upon premises which are less obvious than the existence of objective moral values in the first place. She's right about that. Any argument you could give would be less persuasive than our intuition that morality is actually real. And morality is extremely difficult to deny in real life. Rodney Brooks, atheistic scientist at MIT, he says, when I look at my children, I can, when I force myself, see that they are just machines. But that is not how I treat them. I interact with them on an entirely different level. They have my unconditional love, the furthest one might be able to get from a rational analysis. His conclusion? I maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs. Peter Singer, our buddy from earlier, he was the one who said that, you know, you can kill babies up to a year or two. That's a morally gray case. He says in the case of the elderly, he went on record as saying that we should euthanize them, kill them. He was interviewed in 1999 when his mother came down with Alzheimer's. And you know what he did? He didn't euthanize her. He spent tens of thousands of dollars taking care of her. He was brought to the mat on this by Michael Spector in The New Yorker. What's the deal? Why are you saying that? And he said, well, I think this has made me see how the issues of someone with these kinds of problems are really very difficult. Perhaps it is more difficult than I thought before because it is different when it's your mother. Now, why do I put that up there? Do I put that up there to say that he's a hypocrite? No. I put that up there to show that he's been studying ethics in the academy for 50 years. And he's been reading books and teaching courses and writing literature on this and debating people for 50 years, half a century. And then you put that up against his moral intuition in the moment. Which thing won? His moral intuition. Very difficult. Oh, try and spend a day without saying you shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. This isn't fair. And so on and so forth. I agree with this philosopher here who says any ethical judgment that is no good in practice must suffer from a theoretical defect. Who said that? Peter Singer, our boy. Yeah, he can't even live out his own ethic. That must show that there's a certain bankruptcy here. Well, what's the best explanation for objective morality? That morality came from matter and molecules in motion? No. Molecules bounce. That's where we get morality? No. Or that morality came from a mind. Yeah. And then there's this stuff on free will. This is brilliant, brilliant stuff here. Really good. Very persuasive. All right. We're going to cut to the end here. What makes more sense? Nothing created everything? I just can't believe that. We hit the cosmic jackpot against the worst conceivable odds. I don't believe that either. I don't think that makes sense. Molecules created morality. All of our thoughts, our reason, our intuition, they're all an illusion because we're just a machine. We're determined to make certain choices. We couldn't have chosen to the contrary. Is that the case? Or does it make more sense that something created everything? That we didn't hit the cosmic jackpot, but that someone saw us coming and actually created a universe to make it probable, actually propitious for life. That morality came from the source of moral value. And the thoughts, reason, and so forth came from the logos, the logic behind the universe. At this point, some people will say, you know, well, I'm just not 100% certain that God exists. Me neither. I'm not 100% certain of that. I don't know that for sure. You know, things I'm 100% certain of. 2 + 2 = 4. A bachelor is an unmarried male. I'm 100% certain of that. Am I 100% certain of this? No. But I have enough trust, enough confidence in this, that I'd be willing to dedicate my adult life to it. That's how confident I am. Am I 100% certain that my wife loves me? No. But I'd be willing to bet my life on that. Well, what about I need to keep learning more before I could trust in God? Like, this is all a lot of information. And I need to keep learning more and reading more. Yeah, me too. I've been studying this stuff for years now, and I just have a voracious appetite to learn more and more. I don't think we're ever going to get to the point as people where we say, yep, that was the final line. I'm done reading books on this subject. Got it all figured out. No. We want to keep learning and keep growing. Of course. What about I still have my doubts? Like, you know, a lot of this made a lot of sense, but I still have doubts about the Bible. I still have doubts about this. I still have doubts about that. Hey, join the club. We all have doubts. Everybody has doubts. In fact, doubts are good because they kind of serve as a virus that against which you build antibodies. So when you go through doubt, this is the time where you're either going to swim or sink. And when you go through a time of doubt, you do the study, you trust God through that. That's a time where your faith actually grows during those times. Doubt can be very good. Where doubt becomes deleterious and destructive is when you run away from your doubts. You don't want to look at your doubts. And then all of a sudden, this creates a seed of the soul where you're not dealing with it. You're not confronting it. That's where it becomes dangerous. Here's my final question I'd like to leave you with. How much evidence would you need before you were able to receive a gift? Not how much evidence to being 100% certain. Not so much evidence that you never need to study this ever again. Not so much evidence to the point where, you know, you have no doubts for the rest of your life. How much evidence would you need before you just were able to receive a gift from God? I would be remiss if I didn't make this final point. You know, the Bible says that God not just exists, but he actually loves us to the point where he came into this world and did the unthinkable through the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus was the one who said, whoever hears my word and believes in him who sent me has, present tense, right now, has eternal life and does not come into judgment, but is passed out of death into life. Do you realize what this is saying? This is opposite all other religion, even much of Christian religion today, where it says we can never know where we're going to go when we die, or you got to be good enough to earn your way to God. What are we reading here from Jesus himself? We're reading, if you hear and you believe, that means trust, at that moment, right then, at that moment, you have eternal life, present tense. You've passed from judgment into eternal life. Let me be as clear as I possibly can. If you're here tonight and you never remember a moment when you received the forgiveness of Jesus into your life, that is available to you right now. You don't need to stand up. You don't need to wave your hands, nothing like that. This is an issue of the heart between you and God where you just open up your heart. You say, yeah, I believe you. I want to know you, and I don't have 100% faith. But as Jesus said, all we need is the faith of a mustard seed, just enough to call out to God and receive him into our lives. And at that point, we can have eternal life. You could have that walking out of here tonight, free of charge.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.